This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 224, where today CG and I are going to talk a little bit of Azure news, including some big Kubernetes service additions to Azure, recorded live on Halloween, October the 31st, 2017. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by ShareGate. ShareGate makes it easier for organizations to adopt and use the latest Microsoft productivity tools, helping millions of users be happier and more productive at work. ShareGate is trusted by over 10,000 IT admins from over 110 countries to manage, migrate, and secure their SharePoint and Office 365 environments. ShareGate is recognized as the must-have tool for day-to-day administration of on-premises, cloud, and hybrid environments. Interested in learning more? Check them out on ShareGate.com to learn how ShareGate can make you more productive.
I'm laughing because that's exactly what I was about to do.
How's it going, dude?
Very good. How are you?
Doing good. You probably haven't heard it yet, but our episode from last week just came out as we're recording this. And if you remember, we had a complete screw up at the beginning about the intro, and it came out great.
Oh, yes, that's right. Oh, perfect.
Oh, it sounds really good.
I'll have to listen to it. Excellent.
It's good stuff. So how's it going, buddy?
Oh, really good. Yeah, really well. Had a nice little weekend away with my son, bit of RVing with a guy's weekend away with my son and a friend of mine and his son. So, it was really kind of relaxing and getting back into the thick of it now. And then Halloween today, obviously, as we were recording. So I've got to go run around with the kids later on this evening and while they're all dressed up and all that sort of stuff. And of course, Vicky is also getting into the swing of it and is dressing up as Belle from Beauty and the Beast, I think. Is that right?
Oh, wow.
So she really gets into it with the kids and they have a blast. So,
are you dressing up?
Yes, as a middle-aged white IT guy.
Oh, yeah. So just kind of put on your shoes?
That's true. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to walk around with Jira open on my iPad and take down people's issues. Uh-huh. exactly. Now, how about you?
That was an apple you put in my son's jack-o'-lantern. You have to give him a Kit Kat. There's an issue for you.
Here's an issue. That's right. How about you? What's been going on?
Oh, man. Last week was a fun week. Well, I spent 18 hours in San Francisco, or a little bit less than that, speaking at a conference at Dev Connections. Man, I walked into one session. I was supposed to do my session at 9:15. The guys before me were supposed to be done at like 9 or 8:50 or 9 o'clock, and they didn't walk off the stage until 9:10, 5 minutes before I'm supposed to do my session. And we're standing all out the room, and they got the doors open, and even the conference organizers come over, and they're standing there like looking at the guy, and he's just going like it was no big deal. Like it was...
I'm not done yet.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean...
Man, speaker etiquette. Speaker etiquette 101.
Yeah, but I knocked out two sessions pretty quick, both of them around the SharePoint framework. One was just around 101 stuff. One was around the SharePoint framework extensions. But then I had some fun stuff, man. I went down to, jumped on Caltrain, got down to San Jose, picked up a rental car. And I drove around just to go kind of see I'm dating myself now. It's been at least a decade, if not more, since I've been in San Jose in the Silicon Valley. And I was the last time I was there and I didn't do any touristy kind of stuff to go see anything. Was
Bill Hewlett was in his garage creating a transistor.
Not that old. Not that old, Jesus. Last time I was there was the Office Developer Conference. So we're going like way back, like 2007, I think, something like that.
Yeah, ODC, baby, yeah.
ODC, yeah. And so I did, so I drove by the Apple spaceship, the new headquarters.
The donut.
So the pictures from above that we can see on like all the tech media and stuff, very impressive, much more impressive or much easier to see than in person, because in person, it's one of those things that's so big and it's so close to the road that there's trees and mounds of dirt all around it. It's actually hard to see the building. But it's very impressive. The thing that really got me about it was all the buildings around the Apple campus, they feel like Apple stores. They're all...
A lot of glass.
All glass. All glass, very simple. Like, it looks like everyone was trying to sell an iPad. All the desks look like the iPad, like displays, the little tiny like lights coming down. It's beautiful. But yeah, I drove through that, drove around, saw NVIDIA, PayPal, eBay, Microsoft, I think I said PayPal, LinkedIn, the NASA Ames Research Center. That was pretty cool.
Ooh, nice.
But I was down there because I spent a day with spent a day at Google working with SharePoint framework and Angular stuff. So Angular V4, Angular V5, and working to get it inside SharePoint framework. So more stuff coming out about that soon. I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag just yet, but the Google guys have done a lot of really good work there. There's absolutely nothing the Microsoft guys can do to make that story better. It is, because it really is an issue with Angular, but they've done a really good job. There's some really cool stuff. And frankly, it's going to get to be a hell of a lot better. So I'm really looking forward. It's going to be better, not just for SharePoint framework developers, but Angular developers as a whole. I'm really looking forward to having a discussion with you on the podcast in a couple of weeks when they can show what they've been working on. They can't really do it. They can't show it just yet because there's stuff that has to land in a PR that has to get in the library to be able to use what they're looking to do. But let's just say it's very, very slick.
Yeah, I don't know about all the issues, but I remember somebody sent me a link to a GitHub issue in the SharePoint dev docs that says size of required SP JavaScript files is too big. And then the guy goes on, it's like, is it really all necessary?
Yeah.
It sounds like some people are struggling with some of the payload, like observed behavior, Office UI Fabric React bundle, 1.7 megabytes, SharePoint WebPart Workbench, 1.4 megabytes, SP Loader Assembly, 1.2 megabytes, SP Application Base, 740 kilobytes, and the SP WebPart Base, 230 kilobytes. That's like...
I think that's 5 or 6 megs right there.
That's 5 or 6 megs just in a... like first load. I mean, there's a workbench piece of that that's not going to be in there for most of the time, right?
There's two sides to this right now. Or there's two pieces to this. You know, first of all, there's what you just described. There's a whole issue with mobile where the SharePoint is not mobile friendly at all. I mean, they talk about responsive pages and all that stuff. I mean, give me a break. It's not, SharePoint Online is not mobile friendly and at the least bit. So the payload is just way too big. It's like, oh yeah, you know, it renders great. I'm like, yeah, if you're on the corporate Wi-Fi. So that's not a mobile story. The challenge that we have with Angular today, and I just put a blog post out about it today, so people want to head over to my blog at andrewconnell.com and look at my post on Halloween. Really, the issue is that Angular today, when I say Angular, I mean Angular 4, so the current version of Angular. It's written, when it was first architected, Angular 2, Angular 4 was architected to where it owned the entire page. And so it expected that it was the only framework that was on the page and the developer owned the whole page. So you would have a top-level component on the page, and it knew about all the other Angular components on the page. That works fine when you're on the page, but if you're in a case of I call it a composable page, like SharePoint, where I can build a web part, you can build a web part, and then somebody else can start adding them to the page, there's no way for me to know if there's other Angular web parts on the page. So the only way to address it today is to have this dynamic component that my web part opts into, and then you have to write yours in a way that looks to see, is that dynamic component there? And if not, create it. Otherwise, opt into it as well so it can load. The challenge with that is that I have to have a full version of my component on the page. You have to have a full version of yours and a full version of Angular. That comes out to being like close to a meg. And that's just, while the SharePoint payload's already big enough, this isn't a good approach. And so you can't use AOT or anything like that because it's dynamic. You have to do static code analysis. You can't do that when you've got to do all that dynamic adding stuff to the page. So today I wouldn't recommend people use Angular for the SharePoint framework stuff, but just wait. It's going to get really good. And it potentially could get really good for the Office UI Fabric as well. Not Fabric React, but the Office UI Fabric. People want to do that. So
nice.
We'll see.
Cool. I guess we will wait and see.
Yep. Yeah, same as you, man. I'm going out Halloween, trick-or-treating. I'm actually dressing up for the first time in over 10 years to go out with the kids. So,
ooh, what is?
I'm going to be the dude from Big Lebowski.
Nice.
I've got my bathrobe. I got a goatee. I got my wig. I got my sunglasses. I got my t-shirt, my shorts, my sandals. And I'm probably going to walk around with a beer instead of walking around with a White Russian, because a White Russian, I'm sure I'll spill it. So I'm just going to go with the beer instead.
Good call.
Yep.
Good call. That sounds fun.
It'll be fun. It'll be fun. So, hey, dude, we got a lot of stuff that we want to get through today. But I'm looking forward to covering some of this stuff here.
Mm.
Are you being asked repeatedly to integrate different business systems in ever narrower timeframes with increasing process complexity? What if you could standardize the way you build these business processes so your team are focused on higher value tasks versus the nuts and bolts of running the processes and integrations? Nintex can make that happen. With the Nintex platform, work flows from person to person, system to system, to the cloud and back. Got a custom system you want to connect with? no-code extensions let you plug into systems simply and easily using REST and Swagger. With Nintex, work just flows, so your teams can work smarter, work faster, and be more connected than ever. Try it out for free for 30 days at www.nintex.com/trynwc. While many IT teams struggle with the impact of deploying Office 365, Zscaler customers are experiencing 40% or greater network performance across file download times, as well as TCP and DNS connection times, compared to using next-gen firewalls and UTMs to route Office 365 traffic locally to the internet. While you may know Zscaler as the leader in cloud security, they also have hundreds of customers who are processing over 1.2 petabytes of Office 365 traffic monthly through the Zscaler cloud. Visit www.zscaler.com to learn more. Now, the first things I want to go over here with our news that I want to share is some Azure-related news. And there's one that we got a nice big crescendo at the very end that I'm looking forward to sharing.
Sure.
So, hey, the first bit of news that we want to share is an article. All of these will be linked in the show notes. But Cray supercomputers are coming to Azure.
Yeah. I looked at this, I was like, whoa. First up, I was like, whoa, Cray is still in business. Yeah. And then B, I was like, whoa, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Like, I shouldn't have really thought Cray are out of business. I get, you know, they're not super high on the radar anymore, at least not in what I work on. And so that was kind of a surprise. But they were the guys that always used to build really smooth-looking supercomputers, right? Apart from how amazingly powerful and incredible the technology was or is, they always used to put like really cool designs, like really like donuts on the ground with these towers that would reach up into the sky and all this sort of shit. Like they had really cool looking computers. So I fully expect to go visit a Microsoft data center and see like an entire room full of like mushrooms reaching towards the ceiling or something, right? Like it'll be really hilarious. I don't know what, I suspect they're just no regular racks, but who knows?
I think that's the Amsterdam data center that you're talking about. Yeah. No, same here. I saw this and I was like going, wow, Cray, man, that's the thing with Cray is that not only are they really cool looking machines, but they were also known as like the badass in terms of performance machines
back in
the 70s and the 80s. Today, you know, we kind of have gone in a different approach where instead of having a massively powerful machine, we have lots and lots of powerful machines, not as powerful, but lots and lots of powerful machines that we have instant access to via the cloud. So times have changed, but still, this is one of those like, wow, that's really cool. It's an exclusive partnership that Microsoft has with Cray that's going to provide customers unprecedented access to their supercomputing capabilities to solve their toughest challenges in climate modeling, precision medicine, energy, manufacturing, and other scientific research.
That's incredible. I wish I knew more about this, like, because it's something I know very little about. But yeah, from my understanding, very rudimentary, right? They're not making their own chips anymore or something along those lines. Like they're using Intel CPUs and GPUs like from NVIDIA and so forth. But there's some sort of OS or some sort of programming model that they use or something along those lines that's really particular to being able to get super high throughput. Like up to, they were saying here the Cray XC50AC air-cooled supercomputer with supporting NVIDIA Tesla P100 PCIe GPUs and Intel Xeon scalable processors delivers up to 236 teraflops of peak performance in a 24-inch cabinet with no requirement for liquid cooling.
It's not just nuts.
Yeah, that's not a basic Minecraft server right there.
No, I don't think so. You could do a wicked, you could play some wicked Quake on that thing.
Hey, if there's anybody listening that uses Cray computers day to day or has done a bunch of this modeling and wants to come on the show to talk about how the stuff gets used in the real world, we would love to talk to you. So please drop us a line on the contact form or on Twitter and let us know because we'd love to learn more.
Absolutely. I got another bit of news here. This is around Azure GDPR. So GDPR is a European Union data protection law that is going to be implemented. I believe it's in sometime in 2018 or May of 2018, May 25th. It's known as the General Data Protection Regulation or GDPR. And the idea is generally to give individuals greater control over their personal data and imposes a lot of new obligations for organizations that collect, handle, and analyze personal data. So the news around this that we wanted to share is that Azure has a bunch of resources that are, as they say, unprecedented or unmatched focus on customer compliance needs. So what they have is a multi-part approach to this. Part one is a contractual commitment in the online services terms via the GDPR terms, via the inclusion of the GDPR terms. There's a GDPR landing page for Azure, which provides essential information to customers on how to get started with GDPR compliance. There are various assessment tools, technical white papers, mainstream white papers, and partner resources. I got all these as a link in the show notes. There's a lot of stuff here for people that want to dig into this.
Nice. Yeah, that's a massive deal, right? A big concern for customers and for people providing services to customers and software to customers. So it's great to see Azure focusing on that as a nice differentiator.
Absolutely.
One thing on Azure before we move on that I forgot to stick in our show notes, and I hope you don't mind me interjecting.
Oh, my God.
Was Chevron just signed a massive 7-year deal with Microsoft for Azure. And it's arguably up to a $1 billion contract. They don't really know. It hasn't been reported the exact value of the contract, but it's being speculated at up to about $1 billion. And the interesting thing here is that they did a bit of a compete exercise with AWS and Google. And what was interesting is that some chap at Chevron, I'm trying to find the quote really quick, basically said that due to Microsoft's commitment to like geolocation and data centers around the world, data sovereignty, and also sort of enterprise scale operations, or that Azure is used to dealing with companies like Chevron at enterprise scale, that they picked Azure, which I thought was very telling because Azure's been putting a lot of effort into its data centers around the world. And that often matters for big organizations. And also that they are used to dealing with enterprises the size of Chevron with their, I don't know about unique requirements, but certainly specific requirements. So that's a nice win for Azure. They should make lots of noise about that because like we've banged on about on the show before, Azure's got a big leg up in the enterprise space against the competitors. So it's nice to see them landing some of these big deals.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a huge deal. I'm glad you mentioned that one too. I noticed that as well. And we did forget to put that in the show notes, but that's a huge win for Azure. So
yep.
Yeah. Be curious to see what
really nice.
Curious to see any kind of like case studies and stuff and what they're doing for, you know, onboarding and taking advantage of it and all that. So
yeah.
Really cool. Okay. You know what? There's one more that we had here for Azure. And this one is
huge.
This one's huge. This one's really big. Actually, you know what? Before we do this one warrants one more sponsor call. So
before we get into the nuts and bolts.
Yeah. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of this one, let's just pause real quick and do one more sponsor call out and we'll be right back.
A 99.9% SLA means you're protected from power outages, bad patches, natural disasters, and maybe even a dinosaur attack. Does it protect you from yourself, though? AvePoint Backup for SharePoint Online provides full fidelity backup and recovery, from individual items to entire team sites. AvePoint can run backups up to 4 times a day to ensure your data is secure. Recover anytime you want without having to pick up the phone and schedule restore windows. Learn why AvePoint is the Microsoft Cloud expert at www.avpoint.com.
All right, CJ, you and I saw this coming. We had the opportunity to sit in on a webcast demo for this, and it is not, okay, my two cents. It's not often where you get to sit in on a new product release and you're kind of listening to it, and it's kind of like left and right. It's like everything that I would have wanted this to be, it is. And then a little bit more. And then they throw a couple of the things in there. I'm like going, oh my God, that's exactly what, yeah, that's great. I wish they do it like, oh my God, they did. Oh, this is, and it's, we saw this and we were really tempted. We saw this, 2 weeks ago? We were really tempted to put this in last week's show, but our show would have come out the exact same day that it was supposed to go public preview. And we thought it'd be a little too risky because we might have to can the entire show if they slipped a week or something. So we held off on it.
Yeah, it was a little too risky. Yeah.
So let me say what it is, and then I'll let you do your two cents on it.
Oh, yeah, we probably should say what it is.
Yeah, what is this?
So before we really get excited.
Let me put this in a little bit of perspective here, okay? So this is around the container space in Kubernetes. Over on the Google side, this is a Kubernetes. You've heard us talk about it multiple times on the show. It's a container orchestrator management service. And It's an open source project. It grew out of Google, kind of has its roots, or it doesn't kind of, it has its roots on something called Borg and Omega, which are two products or platforms.
Internal Google systems, yeah.
Yeah, that basically run all of Google, managing all their containers and such. This is the open source version. It was spearheaded in part with a guy named Brendan Burns, who we've had on the show. Brendan is now at Microsoft working in Azure. And so let's switch back to the Google side real quick. Google has a offering they call the Google Container Engine, GKE. The K stands for Kubernetes. And basically, if you want to be able to do containers, but you want to deal with them as a more as like a PaaS, where you don't have to manage the infrastructure or manage the service that's going to do the orchestration for you, Google's the only one that really had an offering like this that was a standards-based platform. AWS has one, but it's very much an AWS thing. It's not one that's out there. But Google is the only option. Well, until last week, Azure announced what's called the Azure Container Service, or AKS, that is now basically managed Kubernetes on the Azure platform.
Yes. I love it. I don't really know what more to say other than that. I love it. It's what we've talked about, or very close to what we've talked about numerous times on the show, about having a service that gives you the benefits of PaaS, but with the power of IaaS. That's, to me, the set of compromises that it makes, or the set of balances, the balance that it makes and the decisions they've chosen, I think gives you a really nice balance between those two worlds of the ease of deployment of PaaS and management of PaaS and the consumption of a PaaS platform, but with the power and control of an IaaS solution. So the way they've chosen to do this is to be able to run Kubernetes in your subscription on worker nodes that are deployed in your subscription, but with the control and management plane of Kubernetes in a managed service that Microsoft manages on your behalf. So in a nutshell, when you go create one of these Kubernetes instances, or you know, clusters, if you will, or yeah, instances, I guess we should use in this case, you talk to Azure with the command line or with portal in due course, and you say, hey, I want to spin up one of these new Kubernetes instances, and it asks you some questions and like how many nodes you want and all that sort of stuff. And in the background, Azure will provision those worker nodes in your subscription, but only the worker nodes, not the master control nodes. So not the nodes that are really just overhead in controlling your cluster or your instance. And you get to size the worker nodes. You get to say, I need them to be this type of Azure virtual machine. And then if you want more, you just say, hey, give me some more nodes. Or if you want less, you say, give me less nodes. You don't have to create those yourself, manage, water them, all that sort of stuff. That's Azure takes care of that. From that perspective, it's a little bit like IaaS in that you can that you've got control over that sort of level of granularity of the infrastructure that it's provisioning. But where the beauty comes in is that Azure manages the Kubernetes installation and running the Kubernetes instance across all of those nodes and across its control plane for you. So if you want to upgrade a version, you just say, hey, I want to bump it up to Kubernetes XYZ, and it will go and roll that version out across your instance. You don't have to deal with patching individual nodes and doing all the work to do all that sort of stuff. That's really straightforward. You also don't need to deal with the master nodes. Normally in a Kubernetes instance or deployment, you know, you have a set of worker nodes where your containers run, and you also have a set of master nodes that control the environment. And you need multiple of them to be fault tolerant and redundant, right? With AKS, you don't need to create or manage those master nodes yourself. That's a purely managed service, 100% PaaS from the consumer's point of view, at least, from Azure. And that's super nice, right? Because you don't have to be a master of, you don't need to be a guru on how to run Kubernetes master nodes or anything like that.
You just have to be like a Kubernetes administrator, not from like managing the service, but really just playing with the settings and the knobs and the dials and stuff on how you want to configure it for your deployments as you see best fit. Let's kind of put this in a little bit of perspective here, because for those people who aren't really working so much with containers, you know, what did we have before when we were talking about this with Azure? So Azure has a couple different container-related offerings that they have before today, before this AKS service or managed Kubernetes. We had the Azure Container Registry, which is basically, you know, we have a thing called Docker Hub, which is a place for us to publish our Docker images, and then anybody can go grab those. The same way I can publish code to repositories up in GitHub, I can publish a container image that someone else could download and spin up an instance of a container using that image from Docker Hub. Well, now with the Azure Container Registry, I also was able to publish to Azure and use my same authentication, Azure AD, and also keep it private. And also, it would be a faster pull because the resources that I was using to host my containers were living inside of Azure, and the container registry also lives in Azure, so everything's gonna be a lot faster. So that's one. Another thing that we had in Azure is we had Azure Container Service, or ACS. And what ACS allowed us to do was ACS allowed us to stand up a cluster of machines, but then with the different orchestrators. Kubernetes was one, Mesosphere, DCOS was another one, and Docker Swarm was a third one. But with that model, that still was basically just, let me just stamp out a cluster with one of these orchestrators, but then I have to manage everything. So I'm still in the IaaS space. I'm still being an administrator, I guess you could say, an IT pro for managing my virtual machines.
Yeah, you still needed to run it after the fact. You had to go feed and water those things yourselves.
Right. So ACS was just like a stamp for going through and provisioning this stuff. The third option that Azure has is something called the Azure Container Instances. And what this is this is like, think of this as one massive node that's out there. And if I need a place to go spin a container up in the cloud, I could say, create an instance or create a service, register a service on my Azure subscription, and then go spin up this container that I need to go run. But I don't want to deal with the nodes. I don't want to deal with the hosting. I don't want to deal with the scale and stuff. I just need a place to go run my container really quick. And that's what Azure Container Instance is. What this new offering is with Kubernetes is this is now effectively Azure says, we will manage your cluster for you, but you get the control over how you're doing the cluster.
A little more control, right? Yeah.
Well, a little more and a little less, right? It's a little more in the sense that I want to be able to manage my own cluster. I don't want to manage the details of the virtual machine, the security, the patching, the upgrades. If I want to go upgrade from one version of Kubernetes to another one, I want to be able to just flip a little bit and say, now go through and update it, and it knows how to do the rolling updates for me. I don't want to get into that kind of, I don't want to be a Kubernetes administrator. I want to be a Kubernetes consumer, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Now, the thing that I think that, you know, there was a lot of stuff when they were doing the demo for this. It was very impressive. But the thing that really got me about this that was like the slap across the face was when they did pricing.
I think I know what you're about to say.
Pricing.
Yeah. Pricing, yes.
How much is this going to cost people?
Exactly the same as what it would cost to spin up a set of virtual machines in Azure. And that's it.
They're not charging anything for this service. They're just charging you for the consumption of the resources.
But wait, there's more.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, if you spun up a Kubernetes instance or cluster in your own Azure environment yourself, and you wanted 4 worker nodes, and 2 master nodes or 3 master nodes, right, for full like fault tolerance, you'd be looking at 7 machines and you'd have to spin all those up and feed and water them and do all that sort of stuff. With AKS, you're just really being charged for those 4 worker nodes. The master nodes are all hidden away from you and managed by Azure, and you don't pay for those. So all of the management and control plane infrastructure is provided by Azure for free. And you just pay for the worker nodes that sit in your subscription. AKS will provision those for you and scale them up and scale them down and do all the management of them, but they still sit and run in your environment. So you've still got quite a lot of control over those, like the size of them and all of that sort of stuff. And you can go see how they're set up, just like a regular virtual machine. But what's super nice is you just pay for those things. There's no per node price overhead charge that Azure charge per node. There's no sort of monthly fee that you pay per Kubernetes instance. There's no hourly fee that you pay for a Kubernetes instance or anything like that. It's all just the virtual machines that you have running per hour, currently per hour in Azure. And I believe Azure are moving it to a per second billing model.
Per minute or per second?
Oh, per minute. It might be per minute or it could be per second. I can't remember. It's not per hour. Anyway.
It's an appealing model.
So that's super nice. But like you said, pricing was just, it just blew me away. Like I was not expecting that.
I wasn't expecting that. This left, If you guys are doing anything, for you listeners that are out there, they're doing stuff with containers today, if you use any orchestrator, go check out the videos for AKS and see what they did. I haven't watched the videos, the published videos, but the demo that CJ and I got to see a week before it actually came out, it blew my socks off, blew the shoes across the room, and then my socks just slipped right off. The thing that got me was that, you know, once he got through and he spun up a container pretty quick, but then he was able to get right into the management console, the browser-based console for Kubernetes, which, I mean, it looks just like the original one. I mean, frankly, it's kind of funny because it looks like the Google Cloud platform is running inside of Azure, but that's okay because it still uses the whole material design and all that stuff. But anyway.
What's good about that, though, is it's like it's just Kubernetes. It's not some magical fork of pain later on that Microsoft are maintaining. It's just the Kubernetes distribution.
This is run by people who really know Kubernetes. It's run by the guys at Deis, who the company that Microsoft bought recently. Everything about it just, it blew me away. And I tell you, looking at this entire service, this left me with wanting absolutely nothing from before. I was looking at using the Google Container Engine, GKE or GKS, whatever they call it, for hosting the containers that I use for my stuff. Now it's like Azure does everything that I absolutely want it to do as far as this goes. The only question that I have, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but the only question that I have is that what is keeping me from using, like, say, the ACI as one node and just being a massive node, just say put everything over there? Now, granted, I know that, so I would think, my understanding is the only thing is that if I want to have specific workloads on specific hardware and powerful machines, then that's not going to work because I don't have control over that. I get to choose the nodes that I want to use, like the DV2 or D5 V2s, VMs or something like that.
DSV2, DS2 V2s, all that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, I get to choose that stuff when I'm using AKS, but I don't get to do that when I do ACI.
That's right, yeah. And my understanding is that they are going to do better integration with ACI so that if you don't care about that level of control, that you'll be able to deploy containers into ACI as your container instances, as opposed to having to run worker nodes per se. So I believe there's integration coming there. Yeah, that would be super nice. Because if you've just got basic workloads and you don't care about the nodes, then you can go do that. I believe that's going to be the case. But there's a lot of folks that run applications where they want guaranteed performance. They want stuff running in their subscription for whatever reasons. They want more control. They want, you know, really granular control over the exact size of the SSDs that are attached and that the IPs are static that are attached and the VNet config and all that sort of stuff that are going to want the worker node control that AKS offers. So yeah, that was really nice.
This is really cool. It's going to be interesting. You think maybe are we going to see Hyperfish on AKS maybe in the future? Maybe, I don't know, maybe.
I would say that is inevitable.
Ooh, wow, that's a big one. I was just throwing a softball out there. I didn't realize you were going to knock it out of the park on me.
Well, I don't know when, yeah. But we're certainly thinking about it, that's for sure. I mean, it's not in GA yet, right?
So yeah. If I say December, is that fair? Not which December, just...
No, it's going to be longer than
no,
that.
No, if I say December...
Oh, I which see, is, yeah. Which December. Yeah, okay, sure. That seems pretty reasonable. That seems like from now until infinity.
Yeah.
Good, I can commit to that.
Hey, my course will be done in December.
No, you know, one of the takeaways from that meeting that we were on, where we got a preview of this is, like you said, there have been very few previews where I've sat and asked questions where I haven't been disappointed at least once. And every question that I asked was answered in a way or with an answer that I was like, oh, of course, that makes complete sense. That's great. I asked about pricing. I asked about static IP allocation. I asked about using other tools against the Kubernetes cluster like Rancher and things like that. And they were all answered in the sort of the affirmative or the you know, in a positive and reasonable way. And there was never a question that I asked where I was disappointed by their answer, which I think has got to be a first.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a big reason for that is because this seems to be run by the Deis guys. I mean, definitely all... So Brendan Burns, the guy behind Kubernetes that came from Google, he owns the entire container strategy and story for Azure. Okay, that's what's in this blog post. And the Deis guys are the ones that looks like they were really behind this whole thing. So it's not like you've got some people who have been sitting behind the walls in engineering that are like, this is what we think people are going to want. Deis is was a company that was doing these rollouts for big organizations. So it's like, we know what people need. It's like a bunch of consultants coming in and saying, we're going to design a service that we need. And then, oh yeah, by the way, we can actually do that because we have Azure.
Yeah. No, they're doing it really well. It's definitely worth looking at if you're doing something in the container space. I think it's a really nice trade-off between PaaS and IaaS that gives you the level of control you need, but with also a whole bunch of sort of power and productivity of a PaaS offering as well. So it's definitely worth considering.
Yeah, it's very cool. Okay, we got two other bits of news here that I do want to share with people. We'll get through these a little bit quick because I know we're starting to run a little long on our show. First one is by NVIDIA. Guess what they came out with?
More chips?
No. Well, kind of. a whole bunch of them. They are announcing the NVIDIA GPU Cloud, deep learning everywhere for anyone. So the idea behind this, the NVIDIA GPU Cloud, or NGC, is a GPU-accelerated cloud platform that makes it easy to get started quickly with the top deep learning frameworks on-premises or an Amazon Elastic Compute Cloud, EC2, their VMs, and with other providers coming soon. And the idea behind this is that you can use containerized deep learning frameworks inside of their cloud. So it's really tailored to work with either if you want to do stuff on-prem, but it's really tailored to work with AWS, but to take advantage of doing real deep learning stuff inside of taking advantage of the NVIDIA GPUs.
Nice. That's pretty cool. I think they've been shipping some, or at least I don't know if it was NVIDIA that did this, but they shipped a container that basically has like all the major deep learning frameworks combined in it. So you can just tool around with them and play with them. I don't know if that was in combination with this release or not, but I saw that as well. That was kind of cool. Good way to get started.
Yeah, it covers a lot of the different frameworks that are out there if you guys are doing this stuff. So the container registry has NVIDIA GPU accelerated releases of the most popular frameworks, NVCAF, CAF2, the Microsoft Cognitive Toolkit, Digits, MXNet, PyTorch, TensorFlow, TheraTorch, and CUDA. Where can you run these containers? GPU accelerated containers are tuned, tested, and certified by NVIDIA to run on Amazon EC2 P3 instances with specific NVIDIA cards. Support for additional cloud service providers coming soon. Wonder if that means Azure.
Possibly. Yeah. I guess we'll see.
So it's cool.
Very cool.
Hey, my last bit of news that I had here, why don't you take it?
Yeah, sure. This is a small one, but a painful one. I don't know if our listeners know, but Outlook.com, you know, for personal email and stuff like that, had a premium subscription offering that let you do vanity domains. So you could, you know, pick, you know, myawesomedomain.com or chris@myawesomedomain.com, and it also made it ad-free and things. That is shutting down, sadly. They're no longer accepting new premium subscriptions, which is kind of sucky, but they are moving the capabilities of that were available in the premium subscription from Outlook.com to Office 365 subscriptions for home. So if you're an Office 365 subscriber for home, you know, if you want Office on your desktop at home or laptop or what have you, you will get many of these same capabilities moved across to that subscription. So that's going to be the way forward to go buy this stuff.
I mean, it makes sense, right? It's why have two different email offerings that both can do vanity domains and stuff when you've already got one and that's where all the focus is. So, I mean, you have a consumer offering version of it and you've got your enterprise version offering of it in Office 365. And this, I get the disappointment for it, but this is logical to me. And I just wish that the rest of Office 365 would get the memo and maybe we can consolidate tasks next.
Yeah. Oh, dude, don't talk about the war. Come on.
Oh, yeah.
Tasks, that's like the final frontier.
Yeah. Hey, I did see one thing that happened this week. I don't know if you've played with this, but a bit of a random bit here. I don't have a link to this, so people have to go search for this one. I know you guys use Slack over Hyperfish. I use Slack quite a bit. There's a lot of noise about Slack versus Teams, Microsoft Teams, and all that stuff. I've seen some people complain a little bit about Slack's memory footprint, and a lot of it's because of the fact that Slack leverages Electron, which is essentially just a
Chrome.
Yeah, which is Chrome. Well, it really is Node.js inside of a client-based thing. It allows you to do cross-platform stuff. There is a beta version of a new Slack client, but a big blog post by Slack's engineering on October the 30th that really reduces the footprint and improves the performance of Slack. The neatest thing about it is I downloaded it. I quit my version of Slack that I had running, the Electron client, and then I spun up the new one and it knew all of my accounts already. Like it used the same sign-in data that I had, the other one was using. So I had nothing special to do to get it running. And it So far, it's really stable. There is a significant smaller memory footprint. I think it takes up, on my machine, it's taking up like 200 megs or 250 megs. There was one Slack and I think three or four Slack helper processes, and combined, they all took up like 200 or 300 megs. I mean, compare that with Outlook 2016 on the Mac, and that's taking up 2.5 gigs on mine right now. So, I mean, that seems to be a pretty good improvement.
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, Electron apps, I think if you've got three or four of them running, things get a little wobbly. Like, you end up with a lot of memory being used and a lot of extra Chrome processes and things that bog stuff down. If you're using code and Slack and Teams and all those sorts of things, it gets a little clunky.
Yeah, definitely does.
Hey, should we move on to picks?
Absolutely. Let's move on to picks. AC's Voitanos delivers on-demand video-based training for developers on the latest SharePoint extensibility model from Microsoft in his course, Mastering the SharePoint Framework.
CJ's Hyperfish automates the collection of user profile information from users in organizational directories such as Office 365, SharePoint, Active Directory, and HR systems. The secure service supports on-premises, hybrid, and online environments. Bring your directory to life at hyperfish.com.
All right. I've got a pick. You got a pick. We all have everybody get a pick.
Everybody's got a pick.
Look under your desk. We have a pick. I'm going to do mine first. Mine's a funny one.
Okay, go for it.
I've been playing a little bit with Visual Studio Team Services, and I've moved a bunch of my repos over to it, got a bunch of work items over there, trying to do some good storyboards and user stories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really extensible. That's one of the things about Microsoft, right? It's really extensible. I've stumbled across this, really good timing to do this. It's a it's a Visual Studio Team Services build task that every project needs. It's called Chuck Doesn't Build Tasks. And it's the Chuck Norris Build Enhancer. After installing the Chuck Norris Build Enhancer, you can just have Chuck Norris build tasks to add to the build definition wherever you want quotes to appear. So now, in like the screenshot they have here, I can see in the build report when things come across, it's associated changes, no changes associated with this build. Work items linked to this, there's no work items. Chuck Norris says, Chuck Norris can't test for equality because he has no equal.
I heard Chuck Norris once punched a man in his soul.
I love the Chuck Norris stuff. That's so cool.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely add this to my build pipe just because.
I did just for fun, and then I had to get a project to actually go have a build process because I'm just using it really as a repository for content. So.
Yeah, nice, nice.
Yeah, how about you?
Wow, people have thought of everything. I've got a really interesting article from Wired magazine called I Forgot My PIN, An Epic Tale of Losing $30,000 in Bitcoin. So the long and the short of it is, this guy, who was one of the founding editors of Wired magazine and moved on to start Boing Boing, you know, the online publication, he put, at the time, about $3,000 worth of Bitcoin on a hardware device. Yeah, so he put $3,000 of Bitcoin on a hardware device that was secured with a PIN number and also gave you a set of words as sort of a recovery key to that device. He then proceeded to write down the words and the PIN number on the same piece of paper and through a series of events lost it. And he goes through the whole tale in this article about exactly how he lost it. And it was kind of silly. Like, you're reading this guy's story and you're like, dude, what were you thinking? Really? But anyway, he lost it and he couldn't remember the PIN number, but he started trying the PIN number. And the hardware device called a Trezor, T-R-E-Z-O-R, had exponential back-off on PIN number retries. So by that, I mean you try a PIN number and it fails, you have to wait 5 seconds. Next time, you have to wait 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 40 seconds, 80. It wasn't seconds, it went up into the minutes. And it was basically like in 100 tries, he would have to wait like 6 trillion years or something like that for the next attempt. It was something absurd. Because it's exponential and it got worse and worse and worse. And he got to the point where he'd tried the PIN combinations that he thought he knew his PIN number. And he was confused about why it wasn't working and all this. Anyway, it was getting up to having to wait like 4.5, 8 hours between PIN attempts. And anyway, it goes through his whole journey. He'd basically given up all hope. What's the right way to say this? You've got to really read the article for the payoff at the end. But Basically, he ends up hacking his hardware through a series of software exploits and getting help from some random like hacker dude on the internet to try and hack into his device. And it was just a fascinating story of this guy who wasn't like, he's an editor, but not like a hacker, right? So he was moderately technical, but some of the mistakes he made along the way and dealing with this real encryption, right? Real encryption means you're really not getting it back if you lose your secrets.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah. Anyway, it's worth reading.
It's an awesome article. And I mean, it's got the clickbait title of, you know, he lost $30,000 in Bitcoin, but he really, it's the fact that he invested $3,000 and then Bitcoin took off. And so his value of 3,000 went up to 30,000. So he didn't really lose 30,000. He was going to lose 3,000 and the proceeds from it maturing.
Correct.
To 30,000.
Yeah, but over the time that he'd lost his PIN, it went from 3,000 to 30,000 and actually higher, but yeah.
I'm not minimizing it. I would be pretty irate, but yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it's definitely worth a read if you're technically inclined. It's pretty interesting in terms of how all the things he tried to get the stuff back and ultimately what he ends up doing to his device to try and get the stuff back. And yeah, it's definitely worth a read.
Oh, man. It's a crazy story. I've read part of it. I definitely want to go back and finish it. My wife saw you post about it on Facebook. She started reading it and she's like, can that really happen? I'm like, oh God, yes. Yes, it can. Don't
forget your PIN numbers, kids.
Yeah, don't do that.
And if you do write down your recovery key, put it somewhere safe and make a couple of copies of it and put them in different places that are safe.
Yeah.
Maybe give it to a friend that you trust and put it in their safe as well or something like that. Put it somewhere safe.
It's kind of like those MFA recovery IDs. You get those 10 recovery IDs when you have the MFA logins.
Yeah, don't lose those.
I know where mine are. They're in two spots.
Definitely.
One digital, one not digital, one in the physical.
Yeah, when you encrypt things and then you ask on their support forums, so I've forgotten my PIN number and my recovery key, and everybody's like, yeah, you're hosed.
Yeah, sorry, dude. this works really well. Even the NSA guys are like, yeah. Not my job.
Exactly.
Cool.
I just thought it was a really cool article.
That's a great article.
There we go.
Awesome, man. Well, it's another episode in the books.
Yeah. Thanks again. Good chat. Love the Kubernetes stuff.
Oh, yeah. Love the Kubernetes stuff. I was really excited to talk about this with you. And we're going to try to get somebody on the show to come talk to us about this, because this is, once they get to a little more mature in the service and see, you know, when we're going GA and everything, we'd love to get somebody on the service to talk to us about it.
Definitely. And if you have questions about it, please just hit us up on Twitter or send us a question via the site. No matter how silly you think the question is, I'm sure other people have the same question. So submit it and we'll try and address it.
Absolutely. And the sillier the question, the stupider the question, the easier it is for CJ and I to not look like the stupid ones, because we get to ask it on your behalf. And we're like, hey, look, our listeners asked it.
That's right. Just remember, there's no silly questions, only silly people.
Well, I don't think that's the way it goes, but that works.
All right, have a good one.
All right, man, have a good one. Did you like this episode? Please tweet about it and drop a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show, and we'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text or record it as a WAV or an MP3, and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is brought to you by Keith Ritchie. For more information on Keith's music, head to music.kritchie.com. You can subscribe to us in iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for the Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter, at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading over to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.